Support for the Media Project comes from the College of St. Rose, Albany, New York, offering a Master of Arts in Communications to advance careers in media, PR, and journalism. Fuller part-time options, 518-454-5143. From Northeast Public Radio, this is the Media Project, a weekly discussion about issues confronting the media.
Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They know the lowdown, now it can be told. I'll tell you quite reliably off the record about some charming people I have known. For I meet politicians and grafters by the score, killers plain and fancy, it's really quite a bore. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They wallow in corruption, crime, and gore. Ting-a-ling-ling, city desk, pull the press, extra, extra, read all about it, it's a mess, meets the test. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. It's wonderful to represent the press.
The Media Project is underway once again, an opportunity for you to hear commentary, analysis, and if you're lucky, a little bit of insight into the issues affecting the news media over the past week. Dr. Alan Shartok, the CEO of Northeast Public Radio, is down here at the end of the table. Good day, sir.
Well, the reason I'm at the end of the table is last week you had an insidious infection, and we were all worried that we were going to get it.
Yeah, we need to spray the microphone after my visit here last week.
Yeah, but so now I'm as far away from you as I can possibly get.
Very good idea, and separating us, keeping us apart, the combatants being at their respective ends of the table, is Stu Shinsky, editor of the Poughkeepsie Journal. Sir.
Good morning, sir. I think you look very healthy.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I appreciate that. For a guy my age, it's good to just look anything at all. But then Alan's much older, so it's really okay.
was that a shot?
I think it was, yes.
Yeah, it's good to get underway. What were we talking about? Oh, we were talking about the fact that we actually had an article in the paper about the surgeon who operated on Alan's back. Mm. And since Alan was the most prominent patient this fellow has had, our reporter quoted Alan in the story. And I made a little nasty comment to say, well, of course, and so Alan got half off his surgery as a result, which is not true. But I will tell you a story. I was a TV reporter down in the New York metropolitan area.
Really?
Briefly, and I decided to do a story about this unusual, at that time, controversial technique for doing facelifts called suction lipectomy, which they use all the time to take fat off people. They just don't usually use it on faces. And that is, it's like putting a vacuum cleaner under your
where
skin.
Where do they use it? In the behind or the stomach?
Yeah, yeah, exactly. It was, yeah, and maybe it's widespread now, but it was so unusual. And, you know, they let us in to do the surgery. We showed this woman who was before, and then the notion was we would go back and show her after. I did a three-part series on this interesting thing. And it turns out that after we had done the first part, the woman refused to let us back to show her after. And I said, well, I can't do the story if you don't show the before and the after. And she said, no, I'm not going to do it anymore. And I called up the doctor and said, do you have any other patients? He said, I'll take care of it. The woman called me back a few minutes later and said, okay, you can come in. It turns out that by agreeing to go on my show, she had gotten 50% off her surgery price. And I, of course, didn't know that. That would be an unethical practice
unethical
of journalism.
Indeed, sure.
You know? It's certainly, if you're implying that that's what happened with me, the answer is Medicare would not permit that.
Ah, right. Oh, that's right.
They wouldn't call Medicare and say, you know, you got this guy shot, Doc. Can you take a little off?
Like that.
We want to save the federal government some money.
Anyway, so what's new in Poughkeepsie? Is there interesting news going on down there?
Many things. We are working on a story, actually, that I think is a pretty good story for Monday's paper. Next week is the anniversary of Sandy, Superstorm Sandy. And we're looking back at the impact that the storm had and what lessons were learned in terms of responding to a crisis, in terms of the power companies' approaches, in terms of just what people can do to be ready for what we hope will be nothing next week, but be ready anyway.
That's a good thing. Absolutely. We have a piece of mail from a listener who says, Dr. Shartok, Mary Jo writes and says, I suggest the Media Project broadcast would be made more interesting and less inside baseball. Actually, this is about inside baseball, isn't it?
Yeah, it's what we do.
By the addition of a media viewer, a member of the media consuming public who may have a different take on the stories that are covered by the print and electronic press. I often find myself shouting at the radio during this program, and I don't ever think I'm the Lone Ranger. Thank you, Mary Jo.
I like that. I'm never the
The problem is, how do you determine who that
person
individual
is.
Would be? Yeah, because there are so many.
Well, you could take them. You could just sort of pull them out of a hat.
Sounds like you have a volunteer to me.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I had that feeling.
I guess so. What is it about rich people investing in journalism? The latest is the founder of eBay. Do we pronounce his name? Piero Omidyar. He is hugely wealthy as a founder of eBay. And now he's deciding that out of his $8.5 billion fortune, he's going to underwrite a new operation helmed by Glenn Greenwald, the lawyer journalist who has been doing a lot of the revelations about the National Security Agency's electronic surveillance program. Yeah, all that stuff. And so this is sort of a piece. Omidyar now joins Jeff Bezos, who's paid $250 million for the Washington Post.
Not so fast. Oh, no, it's the Boston Globe.
I'm sorry, the Washington Post. That's right. I'm saying the Boston Globe went for $70 million to John Henry, who's
but not quite yet.
Not done yet.
And he was a little baby.
John Henry. Whoa. Warren Buffett bought 63 newspapers last week. What do they know? Why are they investing?
Here's what I think. They know one thing. They've got so much money, they couldn't get rid of it if they tried before their time has come. I mean, Buffett is right up there and others. So why not, you know, install yourself in the great electronic house of fame? In other words, forever people will know who they are. They fill their hands this way. For them to buy this, it's like a $5 bill for the rest of us. Don't you get it? Don't you see?
Yeah, but is this guy going to look to make money on it or fund it as a nonprofit?
Could.
I think you're going to see a lot more of the Bezoses and those out there who say, hey, I can make a play at this. And again, what's going to be the reason for it? Is it financial? Is it glory? Is it ego? You know, if this guy wants to fund this organization, fine. Time will tell what it's going to be and whether people will care.
I think it's actually a great notion. One of the things that you mentioned a moment ago, which is the question of nonprofit journalism. You look at the Sandlers, who were the initial significant underwriters of ProPublica, which has become a major power mm-hmm. in investigative journalism, winner of a Pulitzer Prize, or maybe two by now. And they initially invested $10 million a year and created this wonderful the financial backing that the managing editor of the Wall Street Journal became the point person for. I think that this sort of investment by wealthy people is really to be welcomed, notwithstanding Dr. Chartok's notion that they're just doing it to distort news coverage.
Did I say that? You know, Rex, you are really too much. You keep putting words in my mouth.
Yeah, the irony is that this isn't new.
Rich guys
what, running Pulitzer, newspapers.
Pulitzer didn't
A guy named Pulitzer, maybe you heard a guy named Hearst. Perhaps you've heard of him.
Yeah.
You know, Frank Gannett founded my company. I mean, there, you have to have money to get into an entity like this, and you have to, in essence, have a business plan. The business plan, the audience, the economics. Again, that's going to determine whether we're going to hear this name in 3 years or not.
But, you know, I can draw an interesting... Is it inference, Rex? He's always correcting
yes,
me on
you
this.
Can. That's
yes.
very good.
Okay, thank you for your once more condescending comment. But, you know, the other guys you all mentioned, Pulitzer and Hearst, and this was their business.
Right.
This is how they made a living. This mm-hmm. was their business. This is what they grew, and it worked out for them. Whereas these other guys are coming in and just saying, I think I'll have some of that. You know, in other words, I've got so much money now.
They got time.
Yeah.
Do they have the strategic plan? Can they make it work?
In an industry that, by the latest estimates, may lose more than $1 billion in advertising this year. That is $1 billion off the top of what has already been lost in previous years. What is it that they see, perhaps, that other people don't? Are they so? The question is: are they going to make money? Or they just want to have an impact.
Or the third idea: such a deal. I could get such a deal if I do this.
Bezos paid pocket change.
Yeah.
For the Washington Post, he really did. When you think about it,
or the Globe.
But I think that if you look at somebody like Warren Buffett, who's investing in not huge newspapers, he's investing in papers like yours and mine, Stu, the Poughkeepsie Journal and the Times Union. These are papers that have influence primarily in their local communities. And we, at our size, are able to do better than some of the really huge papers.
Right. You know, and why? Could you guys remind me of why you're doing
that? Tighter operations, less overhead, less complex operations, honestly.
Are you doing better than the New York Times in your places?
I don't know what the margin is in the New York Times. Can't tell you what ours is because
it's a private company.
Mm-hmm.
I see. Always wonderful to hear from somebody who is always lecturing us all on transparency.
Well, you know, I'll tell you something from Gannett. We're a publicly traded company. 30% of our revenues now come digitally.
Mm-hmm.
Digital revenues is 30%. 10 years ago, it was tiny. Mm-hmm. The growth is there. The transformation is happening.
Absolutely.
It's a question of what will be the future speed and impact of that.
Yeah, here's another statistic that is a part of that. You know, Hearst, the company I work for, is a global multimedia company, largest publisher of monthly magazines in the world, owns part of ESPN, owns lots of cable channels, television stations reaching 30% of American households. Hearst, though, has been this background, as I say, in magazines and newspapers. And sometime in the month of December, Hearst will become a digital majority company. That is, more than half of our customers, our consumers, will be consuming products digitally. So that's just another mark of what's going on here.
Change, can I complain change, to you change. For a moment, Rex, about your product?
You could. You could.
Yes. Every night, I now get up. There's that magic hour between 1:30 and 2:30 when I get up and worry about things. So I read the papers online.
Oh, my.
And you have a marvelous new app, a TU app, which I use all the time after I'm done with the Times.
The mobile app
yeah.
is not gone? No, no, we're getting a new mobile app in a couple of weeks.
Well, I'll show it to you right here on my cell phone. It shines in the night, and you pick it right out. But it doesn't have everything on it.
Uh-huh.
The reason I know this is because you referred before to the fact that you did a story on this wonderful surgeon. And the first thing I looked for, obviously, was a story I knew I was going to be quoted in. Couldn't find it. So I
That's
know
a different matter. If you couldn't find it or saying it's not published, it is, in fact, published there. Digitally, it does eventually make its way digitally into electronic.
But how do I find it?
Well,
you know, there's always a list. there's always a list of all of the things.
The electronic product is a different product from the print product. And we actually are trying to differentiate the two more because why should make something that is, what's the business model for saying we're going to give you something free electronically that is exactly the same as what we charge you for in print? Yeah.
So now that's very confusing to me, and I hope you understand that I'm very slow. But in the New York Times, I can find virtually anything that's in that paper.
And you pay for it.
I pay for it.
It's behind a paywall.
It's absolutely true.
There you go.
But in the TU, I'm not. Now, if I were to pay you, would you let me have everything online?
You do get everything online. It's just organized differently.
Yeah, navigation.
Mm-hmm. And it's because the product is a different product, where it's a much more visual product. It has a lot more, we'll say eye candy, stuff that really draws. It's because the metric that advertisers use to determine what they're going to pay for advertising these days for newspapers is page views. It is the number of clicks. And so you go for volume. And now someday advertisers will be smart enough to pay for engagement. And that will be a good day for us.
Will you ever do a paywall at the Times Union?
I suppose so, but that's probably a decision going to be made above my pay grade. I'm just the editor of the place.
I see. So to review. Right now, if I go in the middle of the night to the TU and look for the article, which I know has been published with my name in it, and it's not in that list, then that's because it's a different product, if I hear you right, than if I were to buy the paper the next morning, which is what I did.
It's basically organized differently. It's all in there, but it's you just have to search for it.
And the Times Union is not unique in this. It's how it is at most public.
Is that how it is in your place?
Basically, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So do you hold certain things back which you know are going to be very popular, my name?
All that we...
So it has its own website, likely.
That's right. We do. We try to put that. We would trumpet that because everybody would want to find out about it. Actually, we do one thing that is unusual, and I don't know how effective it is, but our major enterprise stories that appear in the Sunday paper, we do not put on the website on Sunday. We hold that so that if you want to see our major enterprise, you actually have
some story like how dirty is that water or something like that.
Yeah, something big like that.
Yeah.
We hold that back, and it'll eventually get out there, but it takes a while. Do you do anything like that?
Well, we have what's known as an all-content subscription model. Yes, you could. Yes.
The Berkshire Eagle has something called No Inky Fingers.
Yeah, that's an e-edition, everybody.
Basically, yes. Yep. Yes, mm-hmm. But for our subscribers pay their fee. That gets them the printed newspaper, gets them digital access to all the apps, it gets them onto the website. Now, there are certain stories that are available to everybody.
No, I hear you. So to both of you guys, if I wanted, and I do, to buy the full newspaper.
Mm-hmm.
At the Berkshire Eagle, I can get noinkyfingers.com, mm-hmm. which I do, and can see the whole paper. Mm-hmm. At the Times Union, can I do that?
Yes, yes. We also have an electronic edition. Yes. I think almost everybody
does
these days.
So ours is very powerful. Ours gets almost 900,000 page views a month.
So that's what I ought to do.
Get an e-edition. Sure.
Yeah.
You can do that. It looks just like the paper. You're getting an electronic facsimile of the paper on your iPad.
And it's built
for
the
comfort. How about on my iPhone?
Yes. Well, it's very small.
Yeah, we have an iPhone app for the electronic edition.
Oh, yeah, an iPhone app, too. Yes.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Yep. So all I have to do is turn it, instead of looking at it vertically, you just turn it horizontally, and then you get more.
See, we've been talking about whether we should actually go into the community to senior citizen centers and instruct people on how to use their computers. It's kind of like that.
The answer is yes.
Yeah.
We've done
that. Very good idea.
That's the fourth condescending shot of the day, Rex.
He was sick last week. Go easy.
I'm sorry. If you're just joining
us. You're not sorry.
I apologize. This is the Media Project from Northeast Public Radio. Alan Shartok, CEO thereof. I'm Rex Smith, editor of the Times Union. Here with Stu Shinsky, the editor of the Poughkeepsie Journal, a reasonable and intelligent man.
That's the fifth shot of the day.
Why, thank you.
Sue, what does it take to get a reporter fired? I ask that in the context of the Associated Press, which has created a great deal of controversy by firing its long-serving political writer in Virginia as a result of an egregious error that wrongly accused the Democratic candidate for governor, Terry McAuliffe, of lying to federal investigators in a probe. And AP is under a lot of pressure. There's a petition drive to reinstate this reporter and so on. And, you know, there are errors. Yes. And there are
Well, is there something called a fireable error?
No. And I've unfortunately been involved in some terminations of staff members. None are exactly the same as the others.
But I'm asking you a question.
Yes.
Is there a line above which it's a fireable offense?
Yes. Yeah, there are certain things that are so grievous that unfortunately there is no alternative.
And what are some of the considerations? We might get sued for this?
No, not necessarily. The way we look at it is, what are the standards and how did the performance in this issue not meet those established communicated standards or practices? Is this something that was there negligence on the reporter's part? Was there a willful act to violate these standards knowingly? Was there a situation even worse beyond all that where it was personal?
Yeah, yeah.
So all of that has to weigh into the decision. It's rarely cut and dried by the person. It's really the situation versus the standards.
So let me ask you both. What do you think of this firing?
Well, it's hard to know all that went on because sometimes there also are dynamics that develop as you try to recover from an error.
Right. And you don't know the reporter's history. You know, I mean, I don't know this gentleman from the AP. I don't know what his performance history was. I don't know what he may have had in terms of union representation or what other factors might have been there. So it's tough to sort of look at it from the outside without knowing the full story and say, yes, that was justified, or boy, that was not the right thing to do.
Now, the AP has had the same problems you guys have had. They've had to lay off staff. They've had to balance their books and do all the rest of it. I know we're AP clients here at WAMC. And I know our wonderful morning man, Dave Gustina, has frequently seen stuff that comes over that's just wrong and has called them up. And I think they're understaffed. I think that's what's happened.
I don't think you'll find a newsroom in America that will tell you that they're overstaffed.
I see.
We're all
right down to a sixth grade newsletter in an elementary school. We need more sixth graders to put this publication out.
Exactly right. There are a lot of reasons. Usually before you fire somebody, there has been a lot leading up to it.
Yes.
And so that's what makes you think, because it doesn't just generally happen that somebody makes a mistake out of the blue and they haven't done this a lot before and so they get fired for it. But this has happened some. The North Adams Transcript in Massachusetts, in our listening area, fired a reporter recently after quoting a student who cast aspersions on another local school. The Daily Beast in Washington, which you know is married to Newsweek, fired Howard Kurtz, their Washington bureau chief, formerly of the Washington Post, after a series of errors. The last straw being when he made a mistake in writing about an NBA player who came out. Remember that North Dakota TV station who had the guy who cursed on the air, and he was fired, and they brought him on the Today Show the next day and let him speak. He was just a terrible announcer anyway.
And the San Francisco television station that mispronounced the or read the names of the pilots.
There were alleged Asian names of the crash landing and, you know, something wrong.
Information provided and confirmed by the airline, I would add.
Right.
Which had nuanced, right? They had another meaning to the name.
Yes.
So there are a lot of things that will get somebody fired, but the question is, if it is not a willful attempt to mislead, you're a lot less likely to fire someone. If the reporter is well-respected and this is a deviation from usual standards, you're not likely to do so.
Now, what if an advertiser, major advertiser, supermarket advertiser, comes to you and says, you know, one of your major sources of income, and says, that guy is writing columns that I don't like, and if you don't do what I say and to fire him, I'm never going to give you another dime. How important is that? And we've been talking about, haven't we, about how tough the newspaper business is these days.
You know, you can sell your soul to save the franchise.
Yes.
Or you can do what's right.
Right.
And different people will say both are right and wrong. I think in this case, you know, this reporter in Massachusetts, I went back and I read the story, and there were some editing problems with that story. It was written improperly without attribution. It was not edited thoroughly. It should have been caught in the editing. And, I mean, I'm not in that newsroom. I know this
editor
just
was fired also. Actually, two more people have been fired also.
But I think you've avoided my major question.
Well, I'd say Stu gave the right answer.
He said he didn't.
Yeah, sure he did. He said once you give into that kind of blackmail, then you're subject to it forever.
No, that is the right answer from a journalistic classroom point of view.
But in fact, we have something called reality, right?
Well, I'll tell you, we have all had examples of this.
Exactly.
We have advertisers right now who are out of the Times Union as a result of stuff they've read in the paper.
Right.
Good advertisers. And most of the advertisers understand that you don't buy access to the news columns when you buy an ad. You buy access to the eyeballs of the readers.
Yes.
And once you give in, once you lose your integrity that way, why would anybody bother to read the paper?
Truth question. Out comes lightning from the heavens and hits you in the head if you lie. Have you ever in your time seen it anywhere in your markets that somebody has done that?
Oh, not mine.
I've seen examples where I think of media who have caved to advertising.
I'm not talking about your paper.
Sure.
I'm talking about in your market.
No, in the market, yes.
Sure.
Because I got two yeses.
Mm-hmm. Sure, I've seen it. But it's a no-win solution, ultimately, because once that habit gets established, once an advertiser believes, well, okay, I can influence that. Now, an advertiser, the other thing that's interesting is you may have a problem, and an advertiser happens to note it. If you have a reporter who's a lousy reporter who happens to offend an advertiser in the course of lousy reporting, as an editor, you should address that.
Yeah, it comes down to the standards. I mean, you know, we've had situations where we've had, and, you know, we consider advertisers readers because they are.
Yeah.
And if they want to raise a question about a story, they're just as entitled to do that as some gentleman sitting on his sofa on a Sunday morning reading the paper who has a question. We're going to listen to them and we're going to respond to them. But at least in our newsroom, I'm sure Rex's newsroom is the same, we're going to do what's the right thing overall.
Both of you being backed by superb, wonderful, strong organizations, which will support you when you do that. But how about the schnook who's running the local newspaper in some Berkshire town, you know, who...
Yes, that's
the
real peril.
Situations could be very
different.
That
is really the peril. If you're the editor of a small weekly and you have a one or two key advertisers, that can be really tricky.
Yes.
So on that sobering note, this is why we need good, wealthy people to support not-for-profit journalism, I guess. I don't know. Thank goodness for the Warren Buffetts of the world and Jeff Bezos and so on. Dr. Shartok, it's been a pleasure as always.
Yeah, but you took six unwarranted shots at me in this thing, and I'm not forgetting
it. I only counted five.
It makes good radio, Alan.
Stu Shinsky, editor of the Poughkeepsie Journal. I'm Rex Smith from the Times Union. Thanks for joining us on The Media Project.
They know the lowdown, now it can be told. I'll tell you quite reliably off the record about some charming people I have known. For I meet politicians and grafters by the score, killers plain and fancy, it's really quite a bore. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They wallow in corruption, crime and gore. Ting-a-ling-ling, city desk. Pull the press, extra, extra, read all about it, it's a mess, meets the test. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people, it's wonderful to represent the press. Now, you remember Mrs. Sadie Smuggery, she wanted money to buy a new fur coat. To get insurance, she employed skullduggery. She up and cut her husband's only throat. She chopped him into fragments, she stuffed him in a trunk. She shipped it all back yonder to her uncle in Podunk. Now newspaper men meet such interesting people. It must have startled poor old Sadie's Unk. Ting-a-ling-a-ling, city desk. Hold the press, extra, extra, read all about it. It's a mess, meets the test. Oh, newspaper men meet such interesting people.